we got to think big, not just focus on the election of the day or the next 2 to 4 year cycle or whatever. Think about generations. The enemies of liberty, they got 100-year plans. You know, they've been at it for 100-plus years, but we're trying to build a foundation so that individuals, families, and communities can find freedom and they can leverage the strength in numbers in order to be able to opt out of these tyrannical and technocratic systems that are being built around us.
Lord, there goes Johnny Appleseed. He might pass by in the hour of need. There's a lot of soul drinking from the well, locked in a factory.
Everybody, this is Brett. Today is Monday, February 8th, and I am on my way to South Carolina currently. I am in an Airbnb, in a bedroom, kneeling in front of the bed, hoping that the bedspread and the mattress and the pillows will dampen some of the echo in this room. Let's see how it goes. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show my friend John Bush. I've been meaning to have this conversation for months. We're going to be talking about the Freedom Cell Network. John has been everywhere. On Solutions Watch with James Corbett, and the Tom Woods Show, and now here he is on School Sucks, sharing information and inspiration. In my case, it was actually the Freedom Cell Network that inspired me to create a smaller private community. We're going to talk about that today as well. If you want to learn more about what they're doing, freedomcells.org. And please remember to check out John's great work. There are links in the show notes. Thank you for listening. And here we go.
Let the summertime sun fall on the apple.
John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Been a while.
It's been 6 years since you've been on the show. Almost 6 years. It was October. Our last show, we were in Brooklyn, New York at, I think it was called Freedom Fest. You remember that? 2015?
I think it was Liberty Fest.
Liberty Fest. We were talking before we get started here just about entrepreneurship. And I think that if we go back and we look at ourselves 5 years ago, 7 years ago, we first met in 2011. We were actually introduced by the great Jamie Crane. I don't expect you to remember that. We were at Pork Fest, and I think he and I were going around. We were like campground caroling. We had guitars and we were going around to different campsites singing, singing one night there. And I had seen you. I think I had seen you the year before. And I remember how well known you were because I was like brand new. I had just started my podcast. But you had probably already been doing activism for almost a decade at that point.
Since 2002, I was doing some 9/11 truth and false flag conspiracy stuff back in the early days.
Yeah. Remember 9/11? Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's where we all started. And that was, I think that was, I was saying to people recently in a private group that I do, we were talking about this. And I was like, yeah, that was my first entry point with people. That was the first thing I was trying to do outreach on. And kind of a difficult place to start. And I think I had kind of burned a few bridges by the time it got around to like the Ron Paul movement. And it's like, sorry, you wore us out on your 9/11 stuff. So yeah, we're not going to listen to you anymore. So there we were, whether it was 2011 when we met, 2015, the last time we connected. And I think there's lots of places along the way. We were both really passionate about the different things that we were doing. Through the years, we probably looked at what we were doing and said, how are we going to make this work, right? How are we actually going to not just survive, but thrive doing this kind of stuff that we think is so important? And we probably have also been at places where we're like, we're going to have to figure out something else, right? Like, this is obviously not sustainable.
Yeah.
And since we last talked, this is true for both of us. We're obviously, I think, in much better positions just as far as like, you know, finances, as far as, you know, having our own you know, entrepreneurial endeavors. And it's funny, we're finding ourselves in another time where we're kind of asking the same questions, like, how does this go on? Where do we go from here? Just because the world around us has changed so much. But I wanted to, you had reached out to me a while back about the Kratom thing. And, you know, I always love to talk to you, but I was like, that doesn't really fit into my core topic, so I didn't take you up on it. But it does, in the sense that this became a pretty lucrative operation for you that actually created some opportunities for you to return to your roots, if you will, and do some of these things that you're passionate about once you got some leeway.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I did the activism thing for 10 years or so, and was basically in poverty, just, you know, getting by, did the whole donation activism thing, had some little side gigs and some, I've been self-employed or ran my own business since 2009. The activism was a struggle. Of course, me and Catherine Blyce like traveled all around the country and did that whole thing as well. And then I had kids. Yeah. Yep. We had the Bitcoin bus, and I had kids and lived in poverty with the kids for a few years. And it was kind of like, I can't do this anymore. I'm not doing right by my children, by my family. So I had to kind of pull back from the activism a little bit and focus on business and entrepreneurship and earning a living. And that was a struggle for quite some time, but it finally really started to click in the past couple years, the past few years. And that has enabled me to come back to activism. Interestingly enough, Derek Bros played a role in all that, because I pulled back from activism, but being, you know, such a liberty lover and feeling so driven to make the world a better place, I felt like, well, I'm doing a disservice. What am I doing? I have these skills that I need to be offering to the freedom world, but I felt a little at ease because my good friend Derek Bros was out there with very similar message to myself, bigger audience, more drive, no kiddos, more time to put into it. And I felt like there's other people that are doing the good work. I can pull back and take care of my family. And now coming back into it, Derek had me on his Conscious Resistance Network, and that got me generating content again and all that stuff. Now we've been working together on the Freedom Cell Network stuff. So yeah, it's all come full circle.
And that's what we're going to be talking about primarily today. But tell me about the Kratom thing, how you got into it. I'm definitely interested in it, and not just like getting it and trying it, which I've never done. So there's a sales pitch opportunity for you. But how did that come across your life? How did you pick it up, and what have you done with it, and what have the results been?
Back in 2015, I started running this underground, literally and figuratively underground bookstore called Brave New Books.
Oh, yeah.
And we mainly sold health products. That was our primary revenue, not so much books. I guess Amazon was, you know, stole our thunder quite a while ago, but we hosted a lot of events and stuff. And we sold Kratom for a little while. My friend packaged it and sold it and didn't really think too much of it. It was just kind of there on the shelves, didn't really market it or promote it. I hadn't tried it myself. And then in 2016, the federal government, the DEA, tried to ban Kratom, to add it to Schedule 1. And that's when my friend was like, people are following me, man. I think he's a little paranoid, like most folks right. that went to Brave New Books, yeah. I believe. And he was like, I'm not going to carry it anymore. My other friend was like, hey, well, I'm selling Kratom. So we kind of leaned into selling Kratom, knowing what I know about the law and activism. I knew that until the DEA actually added it to Schedule 1, it was fair game. And in this time, all the other vendors were kind of closing their doors out of fear. We leaned into it. It's also at this time that I started taking it myself and found that it had amazingly positive effects on just mood, balance, stress, anxiety, focus. So I take it regularly as an entrepreneur. Essentially what Kratom is, it's a member of the coffee family, although it has no caffeine. It's made from the powderized leaves of the Kratom evergreen tree, which is grown primarily in Southeast Asia. And there's a few different varieties. The red varieties people take, and this means the color of the leaf and the veins. Mm-hmm. The red varieties have a tendency to be better for pain, relaxation. People take them to help with sleep. And a lot of people take them instead of prescription pain medicine. The white varieties on the opposite spectrum tend to be a little more uplifting, energetic, good for focus, motivation. They're good as a social lubricant. A lot of people, my girlfriend included, they take Kratom instead of drinking alcohol. She hasn't drank one drop of alcohol for almost a year now. Mm. And the green varieties are kind of in the middle. They're good for stress and anxiety and kind of taking the edge off, I like to say. So there's a whole, one of the reasons why the DEA wanted to make it illegal, they won't say this publicly, but it's pretty clear. It was actually the FDA pushing the DEA.
Yeah, it always is, right?
The FDA is the backdoor pusher. A lot of people are taking Kratom instead of prescription medicine, not just opioids. A lot of people take Kratom to help minimize the withdrawal symptoms as they transition from dependency on opioids or even opiates like heroin to sobriety. And then like my girlfriend, she was taking, when we started dating, she was taking Adderall, and she'd been taking it for like 10 years since early college.
Yeah.
And she would take Adderall. It would kind of make her personality different and muted and kind of strange. And then she would drink in order to pump the brakes, she said, because Adderall is like legal meth. It's literally methamphetamine. And she would just kind of be high, and then she would drink a whole lot almost every night. And so we got together, and like, I got two kids and stuff. And I'm like, this, you know, I think that you're not reaching your full potential because you're really limiting yourself with this drink, and I can't keep up with this drinking, and I don't want to go out to bars and stuff. So maybe you should try this White Lightning Kratom instead of the Adderall. And we found that we did like a habit hack. So we found that she would open her email inbox and find that it's totally loaded up with emails, and she would feel overwhelmed. So she would reach for her bottle of Adderall in her desk drawer. So we said, how about, and then she would feel satisfied and relieved because she felt like she could tackle it after the Adderall kicked in.
Yeah.
And so we said, how about we just interrupt this habit, and you feel overwhelmed. Instead of reaching for the Adderall, you reach for the Kratom bag, you make yourself a drink, you get that same feeling of relief, but then you're not all wired up all day. You don't feel overwhelmed, and you don't have to drink at the end of the day. And then she interrupted the drinking with drinking some Kratom as well, because it helps take the edge off when people kind of are stressed after work or whatever. So that's a great success story, just seeing her transform. And since then, she's really stepped into her power and found all sorts of success. So it's cool. It's just a plant. It can be habit forming, right? Especially if someone was formerly taking a lot of pain medicine, or formerly drinking a lot, or even formerly addicted to heroin. And then they start taking a bunch of Kratom, they could become physically dependent, but it isn't going to kill you. It doesn't have all the harmful side effects. And if you use it responsibly, like I do, it doesn't become dependent, and you can kind of use it as a tool. And, you know, it's a great thing.
Right. Well, the time period in my life where it was suggested to me by almost everyone I talked to was I had a sciatic nerve injury. My SI joint actually popped out when I was at the gym, and the joint kind of presses on the nerve and creates this insane like level of pain, like wake you up in the middle of the night kind of pain. And it went on off and on, but with some really intense periods for almost a year. I think it was this was 2019 that all this happened. And I was just like really struggling. People kept saying Kratom, Kratom, Kratom. And I looked into it a little bit, and I knew you were in the business, and I just kind of wound up going other, it was a lot of like topical stuff like Biofreeze and magnesium, and eventually it healed. But, you know, I still am curious, and I did want to give you an opportunity just because I know you've experienced so much success. I know you've been on Tom Wood's show talking about this with this, that if people are interested in this and, you know, doing their own research and learning more about what you do, where can they find this operation online?
The website is mybravebotanicals.com. We also just started selling Delta 8 THC, which is like Delta 9 THC, but it's a little more subtle. It's really great. Good for pain and stress and anxiety too. But one of the big things that helped me get a boost in business was, you know, I got shut down. My Facebook advertising account got shut down. My YouTube videos started getting pulled, and I can't accept credit card or debit card, for example, because of this Obama era program, Operation Choke Point. They pressure the banks, which pressure the credit card companies not to do business with like firearms, Kratom, CBD stuff.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? If they're going to try to make it so hard for me to market this amazing plant medicine, I'm just going to give it away for free. So I launched this free offer, freeounceofkratom.com, freeounceofkratom.com. And you just pay $5 shipping and handling, and I'll send you a free ounce to try. And you're presented with an opportunity to try the four other types. Since I did that, and since I went on Woods a while back and then Spearco Survival Podcast, and just kind of was like, you know, I'm already known in this movement, why not offer this movement this amazing product? That really catapulted business a whole lot. Just that marketing aspect. Marketing is so critical to success in activism and business. And even if you're selling yourself to an employee, you're marketing yourself, right? You're always marketing and selling. So
yeah,
that made a big difference. But yeah, if people want to try it, they can learn about it at the website. We got all sorts of educational material, and then they could try it for free, freeounceofkratom.com. And we could do e-check, which is totally safe and secure, checking account, routing number, cryptocurrency. Of course, you get 20% off if you pay with crypto, Zelle, all that good stuff.
Oh, well, that worked out for you. Thanks, Obama. Right? I mean, that was, if you've been doing that for a couple of years, geez. So obviously, you know, success and entrepreneurship is a lot bigger than just finding the right product. So you talked about that. You talked about the frustration with, you know, where you were at 5-6 years ago. What else changed for you? What other turning points were there that you kind of now looking back attribute to your success with this, like something that you learned or some mentor that you had?
Well, you know, mindset really is the foundation at the end of the day. And, you know, some people talk about it and it's kind of peachy and hairy-fairy, but it's real. I really strongly believe in the law of attraction and that, you know, where we send our thoughts, or where energy flows. What is it? Energy flows, action goes, or where
action goes. Where, wait, yeah, but people already get the idea just from the words we've thrown together, right?
Where attention goes, energy flows. Is
that sounds right? Yes, that sounds right.
And it's the truth. And so, you know, when I was broke, if I just focus on being broke, then you get down and out, and you lose your momentum. But if you focus on, like, okay, let me be grateful for what I had, like our school bus, for example. There were times, I like to use this when I talk about law of attraction. There were times we lived in the school bus, and it was rough at first because we got it and needed all sorts of maintenance, and we had to remodel it, and we lived in it with two young kids. And when I look at the bus, sometimes I'd be like, man, I can do better for my family, and this is cramped, and there's so much work that needs to be done. It's rough. And that's what I see. And then I feel down and out. I don't feel motivated to work on it or fix it. Or, you know, you just change the mindset. Same physical school bus. If you're like, wow, what a unique opportunity I have to take my family on the road to see the country. We own our home. We don't have to pay rent. And then it changes the mindset, and you're like, this is actually pretty cool. And so that can be applied to just about everything. And when you apply that to money and abundance, and you focus on what you have, and you focus on all the wins, and then those wins multiply, you build momentum on that. I just changed my relationship with money maybe two or three Februaries ago. I remember the exact date. Grant Cardone, who's the 10X guy.
Yep.
He had a lot to do with the success. Since I started listening to him, I think I've like 6X'd my business. I'm on the goal. I'm on the path to 10X. And then after 10X, I'm going to 10X it again. But he was a big influence. Russell Brunson, when it comes to marketing, was really big. He's the one that taught me about the free offer and the upsell and the follow-up and the attractive character, soap opera sequence, all that good stuff. Any business should definitely know about Russell Brunson. And then Dan Kennedy's an old school direct mail marketing kind of guy. So those three guys really helped a lot. And it's not just reading the books, of course. You got to apply it is really where the rubber meets the road, the action, the massive action. You can have the mindset without the massive action. You're not going to get anywhere. You're just going to be like meditating at your house and poverty. But if you have the mindset, you take massive action, then you have a good product and know how to market it, then you can find success.
Absolutely. So the big takeaway is developing an abundance mindset, and that kind of snowballs, right? Or at least it's like, you know, sometimes I'll just kind of catch myself in an automatic thinking pattern that is like very scarcity mindset based. Mm-hmm. And really have to like, all right, get into this, and where does this come from? And you know, you know this is a place you've spent a lot of time before, so don't get stuck there now.
Yeah.
But once you're out of that and you start looking, you know, it's like, I get that people see the law of attraction as being a very woo-woo thing. And one of the ways that I've always explained it on my show is like, you know, there's a reality out there. And if you think about it like a screen, you run a projector. Not, you know, that determines everything on that screen, but you can certainly color it with your attitude, with your perception, with your mind. Yeah. I think mindset is the best kind of catch-all for that. And, you know, I certainly, when I was a teacher, where I used to actually, my part of my job was to give kids Adderall, strangely enough, 15 years. I think that was one of the things that started leading me into the, you know, the attitudes that I had about institutional schooling was, geez, I'm giving kids drugs.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, in that job, I had paraeducators, like teacher's assistants who worked for me, and they were two of the most negative people, and bad stuff just kept happening to them because it was what they expected and it was what they looked for. Mm-hmm. So to find that comfort, they just go find the next bad thing. And, you know, the opposite is true as well. Like, sure, bad stuff's going to happen. Challenges are going to present themselves. Things are going to turn down. Like all of these, you know, we've all been through certainly a tough year. And I have admitted on my show that my mental, emotional performance was not peak through a lot of the challenges last year. You know, but a new year is here. Those lessons have been learned. And, you know, if you're oriented towards growth, that's something that can be turned around.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I watched that with people who were extremely positive and always, you know, seeking the opportunity in a challenge. And then I was, you know, up close and personal and managing people who were very negative. And I saw the consequences of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back. Let's go back to, you're an activist, right? And I remember I used to see you, like, you know, on the Capitol steps in YouTube videos. And I thought, man, that looks like a lot of work. That looks frustrating. And I think you probably some of the things, because you guys got involved with like the state government in Texas, and it was not without victory, but there was probably like a cost benefit analysis that you did at some point where you're like, man, these victories are small for the time we're investing. And I could really relate to that from my, you know, up close and personal experience in the Free State Project in New Hampshire, where a lot of my friends, you know, wound up going into politics, and it wound up just being like the Night's Watch in Game of Thrones there, where it's like, well, you know, all we do is we stop the bad from coming over the wall, right? Like
that's a great analogy.
You know, that's all we can do. I mean, that's what all this is about. It's not actually about expanding freedom. It's just about being watchers on the wall and controlling the expansion of the state in, you know, the live free or die state of New Hampshire, which is surrounded by, you know, Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, that are all very big government states. I mean, Vermont's kind of its own flavor, but it is like pretty liberal progressive place as well. But, you know, we've just had this influx of people from Massachusetts fleeing the bad tax situation created into New Hampshire to, you know, say, well, why isn't there a bad, I don't feel comfortable here. Why isn't there a bad tax situation here? How can I create it with my voting? And then they do it. And New Hampshire's actually changed. New Hampshire's almost a blue state at this point.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, and it's been a similar situation in Texas. You have this huge exodus. Yep, from California. I've heard you say elsewhere that you see this project now as you've kind of returned more to an activist mindset about setting the stage for the future. Like there's a really interesting opportunity in the volatility of this time, right? Versus like when we were all talking about the Ron Paul revolution in 2008, most people are going, what are you talking about? Everything's fine. Like, why would you? But now, you know, government has come right up to people's front door. I mean, government is like basically in people's bodies at this point in ways that it's never been before. So I see like an opportunity for more and more people to at least become curious, right? Like there is more fertile ground for seed planting. And it doesn't mean this isn't without, like, I go on Facebook and I see some things that are very, very discouraging about, you know, some of the narratives that are just being repeated kind of thoughtlessly by people. But this is certainly an age of opportunity. I see it in the work that I do in and around education, and certainly in the whole school criticism scene. That's become just too easy in the last year. But, you know, I've heard you talk about the work you're doing now as more of like, while we obviously want to expand freedom in all the different theaters of life, right? Whether it's our health, our relationships, our finances, our work, it's more about, in the context of this current time, setting a stage for the future. Is that fair?
Yeah, for sure. It's all about future generations. And Derek talks about imagining seven generations into the future. I just love that Derek Bros guy. He also is like, our ancestors survived perilous winters and onslaughts from foreign invaders and all sorts of stuff. And now it's up to us to survive this latest treachery and tyranny. But yeah, when I think about activism, I think about the future and I think about my children. And I think about what actions can I take in my personal life and as an activist in order to influence the course of history. And like, you know, back to the Grant Cardone, I want to think big, not only in my financial life, my business life, but in activism as well. We got to think big, not just focus on the election of the day or the next 2 to 4 year cycle or whatever. Think about generations. The enemies of liberty and the folks that are behind the roundtable groups, they got 100-year plans. You know, they've been at it for 100 plus years. If you pass it back to the Cecil Rhodes stuff, you know, going on Richard Groves and Geodrick Griffin's work. But yeah, that's a lot of what the Freedom Cell Network is all about. We're trying to build a foundation so that individuals, families, and communities can find freedom and they can leverage the strength in numbers in order to be able to opt out of these tyrannical and technocratic systems that are being built around us.
You're certainly familiar with John Taylor Gatto and probably his book, The Underground History of American Education. And, you know, you mentioned Rich, and Rich did the great documentary with Gatto like 9 or 10 years ago called The Ultimate History Lesson. And the stories that Gatto tells about these designs that these powerful groups had going back into the 1800s, right? Cross-continental.
Yeah.
But a lot of what the American progressives worked on in education was a huge part of their laboratory in the 1910s and the 1920s and the 1930s. And then it moved into, you know, this sort of corporate higher education nexus in the 60s and the 70s. And then business basically ordering what they want out of the schools through things like Goals 2000 and No Child Left Behind and Common Core. So we've seen these kinds of designs on people for a long time. And, you know, having been familiarized with these plans through the work of somebody like Gatto, none of the things that we hear about going on today, like there's lots of talk about the fourth industrial revolution, the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset, and people like us are not like shocked by any of this, right? But it is kind of a hard thing to transport to the average person who doesn't have that contextual knowledge. So here we are, you know, observing this, not surprised. But if we tried to take this to a lot of, you know, other people who are maybe, you know, in our lives for one reason or another, it just sounds like crazy conspiracy. So then it becomes more of a question of, you know, operating in your sphere of control. Like outreach is great when you can do it, when somebody kind of signals to you, look, I'm fertile ground where you could sprinkle some seeds and maybe they'll grow. But, you know, that's not the case with most people, especially in an incredibly tense and stressful situation that, you know, always has uncertainty and always has urgency. People tend to tribalize. Tribalizing makes it harder to think, you know, creatively and critically. People say, you know, what should I think and where is the safety in numbers of other people who think that? And that's a problem. But in the whole safety in numbers thing, there's also kind of a solution that you guys have been promoting with this Freedom Cells thing. So the first thing I wanted to do before we talk about that solution, I kind of wanted to hear you just expand a little. You started on this, but just expand on your definition of the problem. Because obviously, you guys have had exponential growth with the Freedom Cells organization over the last year, certainly. Like since all this COVID stuff came about and people have seen a lot of the government responses to COVID, there's been, I don't know if it's a tenfold interest in what you were doing, but yeah, talk about that a little bit. And then let me know like how you define the problem that Freedom Cells is looking to address.
Sure, sure. Earlier you mentioned how like people are ripe for understanding what's going on. I've had people from my high school reach out and they like private message me. They rarely comment publicly because I think they still have a little bit of, I don't know, embarrassment or hesitation, especially with the COVID stuff, but they're like, so this is what you've been talking about government for the past 15 years. And I'm like, yep, this is it. It's right here in your face now. In many ways, they're like the enemies of liberty are the best players on our team because they're really in advancing our recruitment. And the Freedom Cell Network did go to from 1,000 approximately to 10,000. And then we just finished the Great Reset. We now have 16,000 global participants. But the problem, you know, a lot of it, there's traditional tyranny that we've been aware about, you know, for the past decade, two decades, and the liberty movement really focused on the state and this institution of governance that enjoys a monopoly on the initiation of violence. It coerces and controls people. There's a lot of big business elements to it, the drug war, taxation, regulation, protectionism, all this stuff, right? So this is a lot of stuff that we've been studying. People are very familiar with this. Ron Paul does a lot to elucidate. Murray Rothbard really breaks it down and talks about the true nature of government. And so that was already a motivator for action for activists and the Freedom Cell Network, right? Which was an idea in 2014, 2015 that I had because I was dissatisfied with the political activism. We were slowing the growth of tyranny rather than creating more real freedom. When we'd have a victory, it wasn't one or two steps forward. Really, instead of taking four steps back, we're only taking three steps back. But the problem now that a lot of people are familiar with is this, the tyranny is evolving into a technocracy. And technocracy is rule by experts, rule by scientific authoritarianism and technology. And we, you know, if you're familiar with this historical conspiracy to create a authoritarian global government, right, which Grove, Gatto, G. Edward Griffin profess, and it's out there in the open. It's an open conspiracy now, especially that the masses.
It's the logical next step. I mean, if you think about it, like if you understand this, it's the only like destination that ultimately makes sense. It should not be, you know, like a flat earth kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not controversial anymore, especially with, you know, the Great Reset stuff. And so these same authoritarian globalists now have access to technology. And with the COVID-19 crisis, right, Rahm Emanuel said, never let a good crisis go to waste. There's the Hegelian dialectic problem reaction solution. It's entirely possible that the SARS-CoV-2 virus was created in a Wuhan lab. Some people say it's not even isolated, not even a real virus, whatever. But the point is that whether they made it happen on purpose, like 9/11, or let it happen to leverage it, we now have a very real environment where the problem has been so sufferable for people, and the lockdowns and the masks and all the fear and hysteria and businesses crashing down, which it was not because of the virus. That's because of government's response to the virus. To be clear, I hope everyone points that out when people say COVID-19 caused all this economic problem. It's like, no, it's government's response. Now they're rolling out, and now these same architects for a new world order, now they have the technology, AI, robotics, drones, panopticon surveillance through big tech and our phones and everything. Now they have the technology to really usher in some crazy tyranny, like dystopian 1984 Brave New World type stuff. And it's not they have the ability to do that. It's they are already doing it in major ways. And so it really just intensifies and reinforces the need for people to double down on their activism, right? And you make a good point. I had a lot of relief in my activism early on because I came into it as a 9/11 truther, conspiracy researcher, right? Or conspiracy theorist, although mostly it's fact. And then when I was doing the Ron Paul stuff, I noticed like, okay, we're trying to influence the Republican Party. And people are like, don't talk about 9/11. And like there was a Students for Liberty conference that took place at the University of Texas, and they were like inviting a lot of the big movers and shakers in Austin. And I heard that I was passed over to speak because I'm a 9/11 truther. And I'm like, okay, but the Federal Reserve conspiracy is okay to talk about. That's in many ways more treacherous than what happened on 9/11. It's caused more death and war because of that. But I realized, okay, somebody that's going to be turned off by me questioning the events of 9/11, that's not my audience anyway. That's not someone that I want to roll with anyway. Now, the same thing, if I'm going to be questioning the COVID response or questioning the wearing of a mask or talking about technocracy and this global governance, and someone's going to be like, oh, this guy's a Q guy, which I think is part of the Q psyop. Now, anytime you bring up any conspiratorial stuff, they're like, you're a Q person, and you're instantly discredited.
I think I said this. I don't think I've said this on the podcast yet. And I'm having like all kinds of questions now about like, well, geez, what should I say? Like, we wouldn't say in a show that I did recently, I was like, look, Google, whatever podcast services are run through Google are going through, they're transcribing these shows and they're looking for keywords. And I don't even want to say these things at this point.
What, the letter Q?
Right. So I said this recently, and then I have this university. It's this kind of spinoff from School Sucks, and we created a summit last year, and we're building a private community. So it's interesting, like we're talking about technocracy. This interview that we're doing right now on Monday, February 1st, I'm trying to figure out everything that I need to do, like all the logistics of deleting a Facebook group with thousands of people in it, and getting rid of my own Facebook. Like those are things that are happening today. I set February 1st as the cutoff date for that. So we have this private community, and I was talking about it. We do like a 2-hour call every Sunday, which is, current events and idea exchange and some debate and, some support. Like a lot of people feel kind of isolated wherever they are. They don't have people that they can talk to about these things. So it's a space for that as well. And I was saying, maybe I should be more guarded about associations. Maybe I should just put more of like, this is about, critical thinking and alternative education face on School Sucks Project and withdraw a little bit from some of this other stuff. And, one of my friends who's also in this group, he said, Brett, at this point, I mean, let's face it, you're out there, you're mapped, you're connected to all these, you think you're not, like, let's say John Bush is the most controversial guy. You think you're not mapped to John Bush, at this point, or to all these other people. So I said, and the conclusion was like, at this point, you just kind of have to go for it, right? Like be cautious, like maybe be cautious about what you put in print, but it wouldn't sit with me right from like a purpose or integrity standpoint to be like, no, I can't. Cause I've already done that. I've already like hesitated at certain things in the recent past because of the chilling effect that we're seeing. So yeah, am I making some changes? Am I trying to develop something that is, more anti-fragile versus just like, oh yeah, like Facebook is the place where we all talk and YouTube is what we rely on to make money. Like I know a lot of people did for a long time. Mm-hmm. We're moving away from all of that, but I'm still thinking about like, what is the face of this thing going to be? And, I I understand that you're putting yourself out there and you're a controversial guy in many ways, but the stuff that you guys are working on too is so important that I was just like, what would I not talk to Derek if I had an opportunity? Would I not talk to John if I had an opportunity about this, where there is a, you know, a concept and a growing community around this thing? Would I just like, if this was the only place that my audience could hear about that, would I not tell them because I'm afraid of being linked to somebody who I've already been mapped to since I first shook hands with him in 2011, probably?
You know, in many ways, there's this paradox because it's like with Bitcoin, a lot of people are realizing, you know, originally big investors and legacy type people, my father, for example, were like, although he's in on Bitcoin, people were like, well, Bitcoin's too risky. But now the paradigm has changed such that maybe it's more risky not to have Bitcoin. And just the same, okay, well, it's risky to talk about this stuff. It's maybe some people think it's risky to join the Freedom Cell Network where we talk about edgy stuff like opting out of the state. But maybe it's more risky not to be a part of a community and a network when the police can pull you over and harm you, whether you're part of the Freedom Cell Network or not. You're going to want, you know, it's like having a gun. They say it's better to have a gun and not to need it than to need a gun and not have it. It's better to have a resilient mutual aid, mutual defense network and not need it than to need one and not have it. And you're left all alone hanging out there by yourself.
Right. So I think a huge part of it for, and it's different, like everybody has a different risk tolerance.
Yeah.
But it's finding that balance between like, what do I need to do to feel like I'm in line with the people who, you know, like what the expectations are of the people who've come to follow me and with my own integrity. But, you know, the balance is like, what do I need to do to continue to be able to do those things? And I think that's the balance I'm still trying to strike. As far as the Freedom Cell piece is concerned, you've had this tremendous growth in this environment that we've, you know, kind of outlined a little bit over the last year. Can we talk a little bit about where the idea came from and how it actually like works in practice? I heard you mention a book in another interview you did. It might have been with Corbett called Flourish. Is that the Martin Seligman book?
No, it's a gentleman named Bob Podolsky, who's part of the broader Liberty community. That's where a lot of the inspiration for the number 8 came. But if I could, I wanted to just close out on this thought and maybe I could offer some guidance for that struggle that you're having, that internal struggle, which we all have. And it's that there's this dichotomy between the masses and the remnant. And this came to me from this awesome essay by Albert J. Knott called Isaiah's Job. And he talks about the prophet Isaiah, who was tasked by the Lord with spreading the gospel. And he came back to the Lord very frustrated because he would go preach the gospel and nobody would listen. Nobody cared. And he came back and he was frustrated. And the Lord tells him, you know, it's not, the masses aren't your audience. You're looking for the remnants, those people that are going, this message is going to resonate with them. They're the ones that are going to accept the message. And then when society collapses, they're going to pick up the pieces and rebuild anew. And then the essay talks about Plato's definition of the masses and other historical figures, how the masses, they don't really change the course of history. They're not even capable of comprehending complex principles like the non-aggression principle, which isn't very complex, or the idea that we could exist without a government, or the idea that there's alternatives to government schools. They're not even really capable of grasping this. They kind of gloss over it. And so what gives me hope, and I did this podcast when a lot of the censorship stuff was taking place, the Conscious Resistance Network, Derek's thing that I was publishing on just got banned from YouTube. And it's like, okay, yes, we want to reach the masses, but more so, we want to activate the remnant. And even after the Ron Paul first presidential campaign, 2008, I realized like, holy crap, there's so many of us. If we just got organized, we don't even need to care about the electoral politics. We don't have to wait for everyone to catch up. There's a million plus of us. We could really do some cool stuff if we just got organized. So even though there's a possibility of getting booted from this or banned from that, as long as you can keep in contact with your people through like a Telegram channel, through library, through email lists, of course, email newsletters are so huge for business podcasts and everything, then it's the remnant that's important, not necessarily the masses. And another thing that the Lord told Isaiah is that the remnant will seek out your message, right? When they're ready for it, they'll come find you as long as you're putting it out there. So that's something that gave me assurance in the wake of the censorship, in the wake of that question, like, well, should I not talk about 9/11? It was like, no, I need to talk about this because it's important and critical and it's going to resonate with the right people. And the people that are going to be turned off by it, I don't want to build a new society with them anyway. You know, they can just hang out with all the Republicans. But the Freedom Cell Network, you kind of alluded to it earlier. The idea came about in 2014 because I was frustrated with political activism. We were going hard in the paint. We were investing a lot of time, energy, resources with our political action committee, Texans for Accountable Government, which is still around to this day doing great work. And like, we managed to stop police officers in Austin from being trained to do blood withdrawals, which seemed like a huge victory. But then they went ahead and trained phlebotomists to do it anyway. And if you refuse a breathalyzer, they get a court order, blah, blah, blah. So it wasn't a real victory. It was an empty victory. It was really just slowing the growth of tyranny. And then the Fusion Center stuff, me and Kat did a lot of work on that. I actually wrote legislation. It was super strong. It got watered down, but it ended up passing that would require a privacy policy on all 8 or so Fusion Centers in Texas. Nobody, I didn't follow up with it. I thought, oh, we passed a law. That means that they're going to follow the law. Nothing ever changed and no one followed up or held their feet to the fire. We also passed the same privacy policy for the Austin Regional Intelligence Center. And then with leaks, the blue hacks leak later on, I find my name in the freaking Fusion Center database and the threat liaison officer, threat liaison report. They were monitoring the Occupy movement. So we had this privacy policy where you can't add information of a political, religious, or social view. You can't do information and intelligence on that. They were doing it anyway. And I started realizing like, man, we're putting so much energy into this government stuff and we're getting these empty victories. I want more. And also I was becoming more of a voluntarist and this voluntarist movement was starting to grow as like an offshoot of the Ron Paul thing. Mm-hmm. And I saw so many people that abhorrently object to government, yet they all still participated in it, myself included, even to this day to varying degrees, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, what are we missing? What is it that we need in order to empower people so they feel more safe and comfortable and less afraid when they opt out? And so we can be more comfortable to build something new. And really I centered in on strength in numbers. And that was like the foundation for this idea of the Freedom Cell Network.
What I picked up when I was learning about it is one of the great things at its core, it's kind of like that the five people, you average of the five people you spend the most time with idea, where as you're trying to build what you call the inner cadre, that really is about, I think, a special kind of connection with people. The saying or the standard is five people, but the inner cadre is 8 people. So can you talk about like where that idea actually came from, 8 people, why it's 8? And then I probably have some follow-up questions. I want to ask you about your inner cadre, whatever you'll reveal about it here, and then some of the specifics about like how it works and guidelines for setting one up.
Sure. So the inner cadre is the core, the foundation of the Freedom Cell Network. And it centers around approximately 8 people. 8 is the ideal number. It can be 7, it can be 9, it can be 5, it can be 12, it can be whatever you want. It's like an open source idea that people can take and evolve and change, right?
Okay, sure. Yeah.
But we determined based on the research of Bob Podolsky, who wrote this book, Flourish. He is a libertarian, voluntarist thinker. He's at the conferences and stuff. I think he lives in Acapulco. He's real tied in with that community. He worked with this gentleman named John David Garcia, which if you're not familiar with this guy's work, this guy has a rich volume of work as a philosopher, as a sociologist, as a big thinker. He actually did research and like actual research studies and found that 8 people is the optimal number of people for maximum creativity. That was his highest ethic for group dynamics and what a group should do. And he wrote all sorts of books about building these new societies and how humans can relate to one another and the scientific aspect of everything. Super big thinker. But he actually did this research and he found that, you know, when it's 2 or 3 people, you know, there's not a lot of creativity. There's not a lot of opportunity for new ideas and for innovation. Whenever you get to 12 people or so, the creativity drops down because now there's more bureaucracy and more differences.
Yep,
it's hard to be on the same page. And he found 8 is the optimal number. Bob Podolsky wrote about this. Bob's doing something similar to what we're doing. He calls them octologs and he calls it a holomat, which is a collection of octologs. And so we're like, okay, well, let's give this number 8 a try. And that was kind of the birth of the inner cadre. So you get your group of 8 people. It can be 5. It starts with 2 or 3 people. Come together. You set a regular meeting, ideally once a week, once a month at least, in person, in real life is the ideal for this. You know, the technocrats want us to go to all virtual. We want to encourage people to meet in person, which is the most powerful thing. So you can see each other's faces and mouths too, which is, I guess, a revolutionary thing these days. Mm-hmm. And you come together and you work on common goals, establish a vision, a mission. It's like, what do we want to work on? What's important to us right now? Some of the goals that we encourage people to start with center around preparedness. Everyone should have 3 months worth of food storage. I used to encourage people to have 2 weeks, and then COVID happened. It's like, wow, we had to tap into our food storage. I didn't think that this was going to happen so quick.
Yeah.
I live in a tiny home too, so it's kind of, we don't have 3 months worth of food storage, but we're doing our best. 3 months worth of food storage. Everyone should have an encrypted communication channel, and ideally an off-grid communication like ham radio or CB radio if you live in close proximity. People
mesh
should
network.
Have
yeah.
Yeah. Yep. People should have firearms, know how to use them safely and proficiently in defense of their family and their community. There's some controversy around that. So we always try to make it clear that you don't have to be a firearms person. You don't even have to be a self-defense person. You can be pacifist or nonviolent Satyagraha type person. It's all whatever works for you and your people. And then the fourth element is everyone should have a bug out plan, whether they go somewhere together or maybe one of the group of eight has, you know, 5 acres on the outside of town or whatever. They don't have to go together. They just hold each other accountable to make sure you have a plan. But really, that's just like a starter foundational thing so you can be prepared for what's to come. You can have goals centered around education. I did a podcast where it was like how the Freedom Cell Network concept can help you transition from government school to alternative education. So this whole pod concept, you can do the same thing with your Freedom Cell cadre. And it's like our goals are we're all going to chip in and buy a curriculum. On Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Nancy and Tom are going to take lead on educating and hanging with the children. On Tuesday and Thursday, it's going to be Bill who's going to take lead. We're going to go every Friday to the museum. And then the parents are going to have a support Zoom call every Monday to talk about how the last week went or whatever. It can be business success. It can be whatever, yoga. It can be spiritual.
Yeah. So that would be my follow-up question. Could you be in many inner cadres that are focus specific? Like, could you build an inner cadre around common educational philosophy, right? Because you might find, like, let's eight people is four couples, let's say. And, you know, they have kids who are on the periphery of this, but, you know, they might have drastically different or even conflicting ideas about some of these other elements, but they're aligned on the education piece. So I don't know if, you know, building an inner cadre is about finding that connection with whatever the number of people is, you know, you gave a range that can align on, which I think would be more likely if people have buy into this idea, there's going to be a better chance of connection around, across a spectrum of these aspects of, you know, protection and, you know, figuring out how to survive and thrive in a difficult situation. But is that a possibility if somebody says this, you know, this inner cadre is specifically about, you know, the education of our children?
Yeah. So the primary answer is people can do whatever the heck they want. It's an open source idea with suggestions. So whatever works for them. And then the beauty of I'll share in a sec how the cells work together in a middle cadre, then a meta cadre. But the beauty of it is cells, much like cells in the body, the health of the individual cell in large part determines the health of the whole system. The health of the whole system in large part determines the health of the individual cell. So we want to learn from one another as far as what works, what doesn't, and share that information so the network as a whole can become more resilient. But to answer your question, so the idea was like you center around an inner cadre, which is your group. You meet together. That's your core trusted inner cadre. But then you can have one person can be a part of multiple inner cadres. We call them single purpose cadres. So there's like a core one where you roll together and that's your group. Mm-hmm. But maybe not all of the eight people are parents, but there's six other people that are also part of the middle cadre or in your area, and you can form a single purpose with them. Or we form a single purpose inner cadre for the purpose of organizing the Greater Reset, for example. And then when that's over, we go back to this, that, or the other, although we're going to continue on with Greater Reset stuff. So it can be whatever works for whatever group.
So then the idea is to link these groups of roughly eight people into a middle cadre. And I'd also like to hear like any practical examples if you want to give from your own experience from the inner cadre to linking with middle cadres. I'm guessing that is all. Obviously, I'm thinking the inner cadre is best if it's local. You talked about people getting together face to face. But I would think the middle cadre would be like the greater local area, ideally, even though people could do whatever they want, but that was probably something that people are finding success with.
Yes, ideally, everyone's geographically linked, but it doesn't have to be. Like, we have a mastermind group of folks that focus on success and entrepreneurship, and they're all over the world. So the idea is you get your inner cadre group and it jives for you. You're accomplishing your goals, you're growing gardens and helping one another with the kids and stuff. And then you go encourage the creation of seven other inner cadre groups. And you link up with those folks, you're not as dedicated to one another as you are your other seven inner cadre members, but you are dedicated more so than, you know, random Joe Public. And we call this the middle cadre. And so ideally envision a middle cadre stretched across Central Texas with a group in the Hill Country, which we have a South Austin cell, an East cell, Bastrop cell, downtown cell, for example, and stretched across Austin. Then the next step is to you have eight groups of eight, approximately 64 people. And again, it's never exact. It's all approximate. You strive towards eight groups of eight individuals in the inner cadre. And then you link up with other middle cadres. Let's imagine stretched across Texas, and now we have a middle cadre in Central Texas. We have a this is what we actually have. We have a middle cadre in Dallas-Fort Worth. We have a middle cadre in Houston, where Derek's from. And then those middle cadres link up to form what we call a meta cadre. Now, this all happens by spontaneous order. So it's not like, well, I started my one group, and then I found seven other groups, and then we organized into eight groups. Oftentimes what happens is we'll hold a meeting, Central Texas Freedom Cell meetup, and 45 people will show up. Next month, 50 people. The next month, 60 people show up. And rather than working from the inner cadre up, you can work from your big group of 60 people. And then you're like, okay, who is interested in permaculture, gardening, and homesteading? Who's interested in privacy, technology? Who's interested in coming up with ways to overcome vaccine, social engineering, and coercion that's coming, right? Or who in the group, everyone that's in South Austin is going to meet in this part of the meeting. Everyone that's in East Austin is going to meet over here, right? And you kind of deduce down from your group. Many groups already have an existing voluntarist meetup, or the old Ron Paul faction, or the homeschool meetup. And then you could go from a larger meetup or network, and you can break down into the smaller groups while maintaining the overall cohesion of the large group, which really helps a lot to overcome, minimize bureaucracy, redundancy, and, like, you know how big meetings can get repetitive and kind of problematic. It's a bureaucratic nightmare. Mm-hmm. It helps to minimize that because you maintain the overall group structure and that connection, but a lot of the work takes place in a smaller scale. It's a lot like sociocracy. We had this guy speak on sociocracy, and there's so much overlap without even knowing it at the Greater Reset. And then the meta cadres, which are eight groups of 64 approximately, they all link up to form the Global Freedom Cell Network, or the Confederation of Freedom Cell Networks, I like to call it. And the beauty, this is what I didn't realize this early on. In fact, in 2014, 2015, I never really thought it would grow to this level of craziness. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's like 16,000 people. Back then, I just had an inner cadre group, and it fell apart due to infighting, which is one reason why I'm hyper conscious about conflict resolution, nonviolent communication, and trying to minimize the possibility when I can spot it, like, oh, I see this character here. We're going to have to really work with this guy or whatever. But the beauty is, as the network scales in size, it scales horizontally, not vertically, sure. Like traditional institutions. It never takes on a bureaucratic, centralized, or controlling nature. Whereas in Austin, we now have what can be seen as a middle cadre. When more and more people get added, we'll simply have a meta cadre in Austin, eight groups of 64 approximately, regional, single purpose interest, and it can grow infinitely. We can have millions and millions of people involved, and it always maintains that decentralized horizontal nature, which I think is the true innovation of the network.
Now, is there any check against that or consciousness about that? I mean, obviously, we've heard a lot of talk in recent years about, like, natural hierarchies developing and the whole Jordan Peterson lobster problem that has been, you know, thoroughly memed. So raising intentionality and consciousness about these things, even when you go back to the inner cadre and, you know, you start asking, you have to ask of yourself and ask of the other people in the group for a kind of authenticity that is often the thing that works to prevent these larger infighting problems from developing in many cases, right? Like, if people are able to bring, you know, authenticity to all their communication in a real time and connected way, that's obviously going to set any group of any size up for the best chance of success. When people sit on that or sit on their needs, that's where, you know, resentments start to build and problems start to develop. But there's, you know, all these kinds of other I hesitate to call them natural social forces, but, you know, evolutionarily, a lot of these things do come into play. And what is the consciousness that, you know, at the inner cadre or the middle cadre or even the meta cadre level, you bring to making sure you can maintain that kind of horizontal nature?
Sure. So there's a natural, a lot of libertarians and anarchists especially resist the natural phenomenon of leaders and followers.
Sure.
Which I prefer to just recognize, right? Like myself, I'm a natural leader, but going into the Freedom Cell Network as a leader, I try to lead in a way such that I'm leading by example and empowering others rather than hierarchically telling people what to do. And as an organizer for 20 years now, it's really great because really the Freedom Cell Network, it operates on its own without central direction from me. I never would want that. I don't want that. I don't have all the answers, nor do I have all the energy to guide some big thing like that. So really all I do is market it, promote it, and then share best practices. So having that consciousness going into it really makes a big difference. And personality, like everyone's concerned about the Fed or the infiltrator, but what I'm more concerned about is just the straight jerk or a-hole or folks that have experienced trauma in their lives and they haven't really healed from that or dealt with it or faced it. So you go into it with a consciousness that we're all human beings. We've all had trauma. We all have our own individual issues that we deal with. And, you know, thankfully, a lot of people came to the network from Derek Brose, and he does the Conscious Resistance Network, and there's a whole element of consciousness and spirituality and self-reflection built into it. So if you go into it understanding that, if your inner cadre group agrees that when conflict arises, as it will inevitably, we're going to utilize nonviolent communication, or we are going to choose so-and-so who has a tendency, you know, they're a little more older and wiser, we're going to consult with them when there's a conflict, or we work really well with this inner cadre next to us. So when we have an internal conflict, we're going to go to the guys across town and we're going to talk to them about it. When you have that consciousness and when you preemptively build systems to overcome that, it helps to minimize the harm that could arise from conflict. And then if you have a bad actor or someone that has trauma and they just refuse to face it and they continue to cause problems, there's also this built-in resilient methodology of dealing with that. So let's imagine we have a middle cadre, eight groups of eight people, middle cadre, 64 people. And there's this one character that comes to all the monthly meetings where the whole middle cadre gets together and he's like drunk. He's like saying nasty things to women, you know, like he got in a shoving match a couple months ago. And so the first step as a conscious community would be the other, you know, people that recognize it, they go to that inner cadre with that one person. They go to the other seven people and they're like, hey, you know, we recognize Joe's really going through a lot. He was divorced recently. He's been drinking a lot. Can you guys work with him? You know, let's try to help him along with some therapy or some whatever, get the guy some ayahuasca or something. And so that would be the first instinct, is to help them, right? But if Joe doesn't want to be helped, right, can't help someone that doesn't want to be helped, then you go to that inner cadre and you say, look, guys, you're either going to have to get rid of Joe as part of your group, or we're going to disassociate from your entire group.
Yeah.
That puts a social mechanism, a disincentive for those seven people to allow someone to cause so much harm, and also incentive to help one another. So you're stronger when you're part of the group, and the possibility of not being part of that group, they'll either really double down on helping this guy, or they'll say, we're going to have to disassociate from you so we can be part of the group. So we haven't really had to hash that out just yet. There's been stories of internal conflict. Everyone always reaches out to me with their stuff, and I'm kind of like, you guys got to sort out your own home, but I offer advice. But we're really conscious whenever there is the conflict. Like apparently some neo-Nazis took over this Telegram group. And so the group just started, they were like, okay, whatever, take it. We're all leaving and going to this other group that you're not in. And so I'm like, you guys mind typing up a little, like a, you know, half a page report so we can talk about this. So the community as a whole, the network as a whole can better deal with something should that arise in the future. And it's just all about learning as we go, sharing best practices so the health of the body of the cell network can improve in the future.
Right. So it sounds like, I hate to call anything a requirement, but if I could, like openness and willingness to adopt best practices, because, you know, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar. I'd be totally surprised if you've never crossed paths with Wes Bertrand, right? He was one of the people who introduced nonviolent communication to the libertarian community like 10 years ago and produced a lot of content on it. But it's a tricky term, right? Because it kind of positions itself as, well, what's the alternative? Is there a judgment, ironically, in labeling something nonviolent communication versus what everybody else does? So I've even found in my promotion of NVC through the years on School Sucks that
there's a kind of resistance to it. So I think there would have to be some kind of process if somebody's interested in setting up an inner cadre of like, well, these are the principles, these are the guiding principles or best practices that are important to us. So you'd want to be really deliberate about a potential member's willingness to say, I don't just accept that in theory, like I am willing to practice that. You know, there's lots of things where I'm sure, you know, couples get into problems and they say, you know, I love you, I want to stay together. And it's like, okay, these are the things we need to do. And it's like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Right. So, you know, I mean, just as far as like whatever it is, I mean, it could be different things for different couples, therapy, sure, whatever. But that could be a challenging feature of this as well. So I don't know if, you know, these best practices are outlined somewhere or they're discussed and updated, but it sounds like that is something that's happening, that people are continuously testing and at least trying to come up with like an inventory of recommendations.
Yes. And, you know, for the longest time, I tried to be as hands-off as possible. Like I have a business to run, family to raise, and I'm seeing now as the network grows and it's like, wow, this is a pretty big deal now. I think that myself with my knowledge and my wisdom and experience with organizing and stuff, I think I need to play a more active role in solidifying some recommendations and guidelines, but at the same time, always indicating like, this is what we suggest. These are the best practices. I don't know. I've never built a free society from the ground up before, so I honestly don't know what the best way to go is, but this is what I think is the best way based on A, B, C, and D. What do you think is the best? And what do you think has worked for your group? What hasn't worked? And we try to create a culture of sharing information. Like I said, I think it's really cool, the freedom cell, like cell in a body, health of the cell, health of the body, health of the body, health of the cell. We're really trying to put that into practice.
So there's another piece of this that I want to talk about as well. Mention Wes. He and I just did a big series on integral theory. I don't know if you've ever come across integral theory. It's primarily the work of Ken Wilber, but there's a huge online community around it. And they have a website, integralworld.net. And we stumbled across this guy, Brian O'Doherty, who's going to probably be on my show soon. And he talked about integral government and got into this idea of panarchy. So there's these two great articles. I'll link them in the show notes. One is called Panarchy, the Political Paradigm of an Integral Society. And the other one is called A Peaceful Path to an Integral Society. And one of the several focal points, but one is counter-economics, right? And he calls on the work of Samuel Edward Konkin III several times in this. And I know that he kind of informs some of the philosophy behind the Freedom Cell movement as well.
Yeah, for sure. Konkin is big. I first discovered his work back in 2009, and this was around the time that I was like, well, I don't want to be a Republican. This isn't cool. This isn't me. This isn't my tribe. And I was learning about Murray Rothbard and then Samuel Konkin, agorism, revolutionary market anarchism. I like to describe it as the idea that rather than competing within the state, we should compete with the state. Mm-hmm. And so counter-economics is what he defines. Counter-economic activity as anything that defies or evades the state. So even this podcast would be an example of counter-economics. But to make it more specific, it's like black and gray markets, those activities or goods or services that are expressly prohibited by the state being black markets, those activities that require permission or regulation from the state, but you avoid or defy that would be gray markets. Mm-hmm. And so it definitely plays a big role.
Oh, can I make a distinction really quickly?
Go ahead.
If there's four markets and you just named two, the ones that the state says are basically not okay or you need special permission, the contrast to that would be the white market, which is based on violence. It's sort of the above board regulated uh-huh. market. But the other one, which often gets confused with the black market, is the red market, right? So this is violent transactions. So like racketeering is basically the red market. So even though people would say, well, you know, there's a white market and a black market, there's what's okay, and then there's the things that are not allowed. I mean, I think that's the basic mainstream understanding of a market distinction based on what you're permitted to do. But to build it out into these four, where like counter economics is gray and black, and the violence, because those can be conducted peacefully. Yeah. The violent markets are the white, what the state approves and what the state engages in, and the red, which is like this
micro version of the state in the form of organized crime, how they conduct business. But the red and the white look shockingly similar in ways that unfortunately most people will never want to acknowledge.
I was never familiar with the whole quad way of looking at it in the red market. That's I like that. Yeah, because the gray and black markets, they're like illegal or prohibited or no, but they're still peaceful. And the red market sounds like it's the black market activity, but where there's someone's being violent, coerced, you know, I guess illegitimate violence, because the white market state stuff is legitimized in the minds of the masses.
Sure. So you'd see a big overlap between, because of the white market operations, right? The black market and the red market are forced to merge. So like there's all this demand that the black market satisfies, but then because of the competition that develops in trying to satisfy these demands in the black market, it's like, hey, we're already breaking all the laws, so let's just break more laws, you know? I mean, that's basically how it works. I mean, this is the whole, you know, stop the drug war argument, is that once something exists in the black market, it welcomes the red market since it's, you know, already below board, so to speak.
Yeah, and then I remember Porkfest, the older woman, she won Soapbox Idol talking about the mafia versus the government.
Yes.
Why the mafia is better than the government. Well, I was going to say with the advent of the COVID tyranny, and now that we see the very real possibility of, I don't think there's going to be very many mandatory vaccination laws, although New York State is clearing the way for that, and Australia is in some regards. Really, they're going to do this social pressure where it's like, if you don't have the vaccine or a COVID immunity passport, digital immunity certificate, like Bill Gates talked about early on, then you can't fly.
Corporate pressure too.
Internationally or domestic. Yeah, corporate pressure. You can't be employed. Maybe you can't have access to these types of buildings or the grocery store. So the counter economic influence over solutions has really played a big part in the Freedom Cell Network. And we're like, okay, well, let's create a strong, resilient, high volume network where if we're not able to fly, then we've linked up with Dolores Cahill, who was a headliner at the Greater Reset, and she is starting Freedom Airways. So we're going to have a network and conglomeration of airlines that are willing, or we're going to have private charter jets that we all chip in on to subsidize flights, or the Freedom Cell Network, someone in the Freedom Cell Network is going to see a business opportunity, which is already being discussed, to invest in some RVs or some passenger vans that people can use for internal U.S. travel. Or, okay, we can't enter the Whole Foods because we're not wearing a mask or we don't have a COVID passport. Well, that's fine because we have our own resilient, decentralized, local food production systems and trade networks already. Or, okay, well, I don't want to be employed by you anyway, and I now have 16,000 people that I can go to exchange goods or services or to engage in entrepreneurship. And it's all just about supporting one another through this transition. And I like to say that there's a duality of purpose with the Freedom Cell Network. On the one hand, it is to protect ourselves, to insulate ourselves from existing tyranny and future technocracy. But that's like a lower level goal. The real purpose, the most important purpose, is to create a social organization that allows human beings to fully embrace their inherent sovereignty in a manner that's never been experienced before in the history of humankind. And that's my eyes on that prize. And it may take 20 years, it may take a couple generations, but I think that it's important to lay the groundwork because we as human beings deserve a lot better than what we've had.
I think it's so important too. And so many thoughts come up for me right here where there's, you know, my audience is big enough and it's a space big enough where people can have dramatically different views on anything that we've talked about, right? The legitimacy of the whole COVID story. Like I have space for people who have opposing views on that as long as they're curious, as long as they're critical, and as long as they're polite. Right?
Sure. Like,
that's fine with me. I mean, we did a series, my friend Daryl Becker and I did a series middle of last year where we kind of explored the various controversial aspects of the whole COVID scene, right? And, you know, there's certainly dissenting. I mean, our opinions dissented from each other at a certain point. So we're not.
Who knows, man?
Yeah. Yeah, and who knows? And who even, you know what? I'll say it. Who even knows what happened on 9/11? Exactly. I don't, you know? So. Yeah. None of that. It's kind of like go back to sphere of control and what do we do?
Yeah.
how much time do we want to spend arguing on what the truth of, you know, all of the COVID stuff is? It's like, we definitely see that there is a response that seems pretty real.
Yeah.
And then it's the question of back to like things we can control. What are we going to do about it? So I'm just going to advocate right now for a person who might listen to you talk at various points in this conversation and go, well, why not just, you know, I mean, if this is about health or doing these things for health, when I talk to people like that, and they're welcome to listen to the show, and they're welcome to criticize what we say, and that's great as far as I'm concerned. But what I've said to people who are very, very blue-pilled about this whole thing, which I would say extends, most of those people are not in the audience of this show, when you're on social media shaming people for not doing exactly what they're told, you should know, right? While you're saying, I'm pro-science, I'm a good citizen, I do all the we've heard various versions of this since, you know, we became aware of the problems, right? Like this was the same thing with the TSA, like 10, 15 years ago, right? So you should probably know what your line in the sand is though, good citizen, right? Because now we know that it's going to be crossed. And you should probably have a plan for when it is crossed. So I hear the people that might be saying like, I don't like some of this talk. Fine. I get that. And you're entitled to that. But whatever your line in the sand is yet, if it hasn't been crossed, I don't want to make a slippery slope logical fallacy here, but there's a very good chance from the evidence that we've seen over the last year that it is. Remember when they said you have to wear masks and some people said, well, that's my line. And a whole bunch of other people said, you know what? Fuck you. That's not my line. I'm still going to be a good citizen. Well, now you have to wear two.
Right? Or three. It three seems... is 90% effective.
Right. And then there's going to be an anal probe, right? So now it's three masks and an anal probe because you didn't draw where your line was supposed to be, right? So I understand. I certainly understand, you know, skepticism about some of the things that we've talked about, but know what that line is and have a plan for when it gets crossed. The best you can detail that plan. Like my plan's not perfect. And, you know, I've talked to other people really, like my friend Zach Slabeck, who's another Praxis guy. He was just on the show. And he said, I don't have a perfect idea of what my plan looks like, but I'm planning, you know, I'm planning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then I have, you know, people in my life who have been far less alarmist about this than I have. You know, I tend to be a little bit of an alarmist sometimes. I certainly spent last year in a frequent state of alarmism about a lot of what was happening. But still, you know, they're making plans to survive and thrive in this situation, thrive especially. So that's all great stuff. And I'm going to clarify this in the monologue that I do before our interview starts, because I think we might have confused a couple people using the greater reset phrase. And they're going, are Brett and John involved with a Klaus Schwab thing? That's not what we're talking about. That's not what we're talking about. You did a you were part of putting on a conference that just wrapped up a few days ago, right? Called the Greater Reset. Can you talk about how people can still get it? The conference was virtual and in person, kind of hybrid. Obviously, because of that, all of this stuff has been recorded. People can probably still access it and follow up with presenters. So can you just talk a little bit about how that happens? And if you want, how it was organized?
Yeah. So let me just define the Great Reset real quick.
Oh, yeah.
The Great Reset is it's a marketing plan. James Corbett called it this also. And that was an insight that I had. It's a marketing plan for what can be summed up as New World Order 2.0. They want to dramatically change the relationship between the individual and government, between the individual and business. They want to remake capitalism away from a shareholder profit driven economy towards what they call stakeholder capitalism, where you have to be accountable to every single person that could have a stake in a community. They want to shift it away from profit motive towards the ultimate aim is to align with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, also known as Agenda 2030, which is the same thing. It's a reiteration of Agenda 21, which many people are familiar with.
And which has infected the education system since the early 1990s, at least. Agenda 21 programming. Yeah. There's a group called EdWatch that did a whole expose. I think the guy's name was Michael Chapman might have been his name, but people Google SchoolSucksProject.com or search SchoolSucksProject.com for EdWatch or search anything for EdWatch Agenda 21, and you can find tons of stuff on this. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I need to check that out. They want to usher in this fourth industrial revolution you mentioned earlier, which they want to merge biology and technology, not just humans. Like Microsoft is working on a planetary computer, they call it, where they can track and trace all the biodiversity on Earth. And they say they want to do all this stuff in order to benefit the environment and to overcome poverty. But in reality, these are the same oligarchs that have been pushing all sorts of, you know, the International Monetary Fund, all these global governance projects, and they really want to control people. And this will resonate with you and your audience as far as the education goes. I interviewed this woman named Julianne Romanello, who formerly taught at Tulsa University. Mm-hmm. And she started hearing all these Agenda 21 style buzzwords and impact and all sorts of stuff. And she's like, what is this? What's changing? And she came to find out that there was this tax-exempt foundation, which we all know have super amounts of influence, the Bill and Melinda Gates, the Rockefellers especially. Yep. And this Kaiser Family Foundation, this guy basically stacked the board of directors at Tulsa, and he gave all sorts of money to the university. And in Tulsa, the city, they're rolling out what's called the P20 pipeline. So I like to tell the story to kind of describe what the Great Reset is all about. And so the tax-exempt foundations, they invest tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in different institutions, education being one of them. They have this P20 pipeline, which means preschool to PhD, where the tax-exempt foundations and the oligarchs will invest, and they have desirable outcomes. The outcomes that they're investing in right now in Tulsa are such that the preschool, elementary, secondary, high school, and college, university scene are all geared towards molding the children so that they can better fulfill the future industrial growth in areas, the fourth industrial revolution areas, such as robotics, AI, and drones. Those are the big ones in Tulsa. And to make it even worse, there's something called pay for success or impact investing, whereby the money's invested with these desired outcomes. And then there's financial markets that are built around whether or not these desired outcomes are going to be fulfilled. And the financial markets place options, they do options betting where they long or short the outcome. And there's like human capital bonds that are being made. Blockchain technology is going to underpin a lot of the tracking and tracing on whether or not these impacts or these desirable outcomes come to fruition. And that was a big eye-opener for me, because a lot of the Great Reset stuff, it's like their goal is to have this all implemented by 2030. And it's like, whoa, slow down. This stuff is already in place, and it's only spreading. And so they had their meeting the 25th through the 29th. They usually do it in Davos, Switzerland, the World Economic Forum, this group of oligarchs. And they had it virtually. And Derek Bros and myself, just a little over a month ago, we were like, you know what? Well, I guess we kind of started chattering about it a few months ago. We're like, we should do something to counter their Great Reset. You know, we should call it the Greater Reset. We should, when they're hosting their meeting, we should host an alternative look. Because we agree, we don't want to go back to the way things were, right? But we certainly don't want to go to this quote unquote new normal. We want our own new normal, a new normal based on decentralization, based on liberating side of technology, encryption and blockchain, decentralized blockchains, education, homeschooling, unschooling, higher consciousness, right? They want to help the environment by doing carbon tax, cap and trade, all sorts of stuff like that. We want to help the environment by encouraging people to shop local and to engage in permaculture and regenerative agriculture. So we hosted this event. You can check it out at thegreaterreset.org, thegreaterreset.org. All of the presenters are documented there. We had so many amazing speakers: James Corbett, Jack Spierko, this woman Lainey Liberty talked about unschooling and partnership parenting. Rosa Corey presented on Agenda 21. Christian Westbrook, the Ice Age farmer. Stephen Brooks, who did a lot on permaculture and intentional community. Richard Grove presented as well. We added him. It was really cool, and it was called the Greater Reset Activation. So we wanted to kind of differentiate ourselves from a traditional conference or festival in that the whole purpose of the presentation was to activate people, to inspire them and move them to action. So every day we talked a little bit about the problem, maybe like 5% problem, and the rest of the day was really focused on practical steps and strategies that people can implement in their lives so they can find more freedom. And the Freedom Cell Network, like I was saying before COVID, it was like 1,000 people, then it grew to 10 to 12,000. And then since the Greater Reset took place, it grew to over 16,000. I think we really hit it out of the park with this overall concept, because everyone's just so disillusioned and overwhelmed right now, and they're very anxious and thirsty for solutions. And we presented some really solid ones there.
Yeah, I thought the organization of it was very cool. I don't know if you were using the same structure of the other conference, but you have a day on Agora, a day on health, a day on nature, a day on digital, and a day on community.
That was the idea.
Yeah. It's awesome. So, and that's thegreaterreset.org. Can you, Freedom Cells is just freedomcells.org, right?
Freedomcells.org. Yep. We have a people see it as a social network, although we want to avoid, we don't want people just going and posting and sharing news and stuff. The whole purpose of the back end, so you register at freedomcells.org, you sign up, you put your name, your skills. There's actually a map. Don't put your home address, but put a park down the road or a coffee shop. And then you could see, you know, people are surprised. They tap in and there's tons of people already in their area and cells already in their area. And if there's not, then we are relying on you to become a leader, step outside of your comfort zone and host some meetings. Go ahead and create a cell and people will reach out to you. And it's just really growing exponentially. It's super cool.
Yep. And at 2017, I was able to cover 10,000 car miles across the country and back, never having to, if I didn't want to, never having to drive for more than 4 hours without finding a friendly place to stop related to the School Sucks project. So
that's wealth right there.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it you're really right. It really is. And I was just kind of thinking about this. I'm in Western PA right now, and I'll probably be here for a little bit longer. But I'm just thinking, oh man, there's so many great people in Cleveland, which is just a quick drive on the highway. And then there's a whole bunch of people in Pittsburgh, which isn't far away from either. And there's some of the greatest people I met on the other side of the state in Philly. And you probably met a lot of these people too here and there. So, I would definitely recommend going on there and checking out what's around you. And I just wish you the greatest luck with this continued growth. And I'm definitely going to reach out to Derek. I'd like to talk to him about it as well. But we should follow up sooner than later and have another conversation more about some of the nuts and bolts of this whole thing and sharing success stories, because I took my limited understanding of the concept and combined it with some work that I did with a couple of guys a few years back. We're trying to set up actually like a paid social network. Like the reason why Facebook and Twitter are these massive dumps is because nobody has to put any skin in the game to use them in a lot. Now that's something we can keep specific to social media, but I have this Facebook group that it's just a Facebook group, right? It's just attracting people based on an idea into a so-called community that isn't a community. It has virtually no intentionality to it. And, you know, with all the challenges of, you know, being on a platform like that, not wanting to be there anymore, not wanting to have all these data points collected on me, not wanting to be spied on, not wanting to suddenly get the group deleted because people are using the wrong language in it. I said, you know, I'm just going to create my own smaller community that is more intentional. So that is one of the things that I've been working on over the last month. It's going very well. I want to credit you with some inspiration for that. So I'm very glad we get to talk about this today. And we should do it again soon, John.
Yeah, for sure. I do a podcast too, livefreenow.show. It's the Live Free Now podcast. I'd love to have you on because I've been watching from the sidelines at the growth and just consistency and persistence of your project. And it's really been inspirational to see it grow.
Awesome. I appreciate that. And I would, anytime, I'd love to have another conversation.
Awesome. Thanks.
They tell us that we don't understand. We do. They tell us that we're all lazy. We ain't. They tell us that we're going to hell. We are. They tell us that the my nene, they tell us who to hate, 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 we won't. They tell me that I'm violent, nay. They tell you that you missed your mark, you didn't. They tell us we have equal chance, and we don't. Well, maybe we should all bring them in close, calm them all down till they feel soothed. Show them we can all change water into wine once we understand the best purpose for life. Be realistic with your reflection, maybe some of us should let go. To help the lost children, keep our mind center on our education. Go take a journalist job, then lie. Become a policeman, then just lie. Get elected leader, and then lie. Say you're a man of faith, then lie. Just speak the truth is all we cry. Protect the innocent is all we cry.